the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, we hear about it every single day. 10,000 Americans are heading into retirement as the baby boomers age. But that retirement brings on difficulty. Elder abuse to even making it through retirement without dying broke. Joining me on the program is attorney, author, and Forbes columnist Carolyn Rosenblatt. Let's talk about some of the issues that are arising today in the kind of retirement market we're seeing. A couple things have changed that. The security of defined benefit pension plans have gone away. We're dealing in an investment market where you're seeing negative, if not zero, interest rates. And what is happening is a lot of individuals are finding that they're ending up taking care of their parents. So let's begin with that. And the issues that this raises is mom and dad age.
Yeah, it's certainly becoming more of a problem than it ever was before, because people are living longer than they ever have in the history of this country, in the history of the world for that matter. And it's great because everybody thinks longevity is wonderful, but we forget that our health span, that is the number of years that we remain healthy and independent, is not increasing in the same way that our lifespan is increasing. In fact, we're not doing so well with that. So there are more people who have impairments, age-related disabilities, and consequently a need for care. That is hideously expensive, so we've got to devise ways to address that. And families are finding that they have to take on more responsibility than they ever planned on.
One of the things that I think is not incorporated in retirement planning, you think, okay, let's say you made a salary of $100,000 a year, you retire, and maybe with Social Security investments, you're making $60,000, $70,000 a year. You're living retirement. But what people aren't thinking about is the issue that you just raised, because a couple at age 65 could end up spending 20 to 25 years in retirement. And I just read a statistic the other day, Carolyn, that a man age 65 has a 25% probability living into his 90s. Well, we know the older we get, we start running into capacity issues, and we know that we have to pay more and more for medical expenses. And so one of the issues that we're seeing, and the builders here in California are starting to incorporate it, they're making or adding on extra rooms, guest houses, because we're seeing multiple family living in the same residence.
Yes, and it's really the most cost-effective way there is to manage the care of an aging parent, when the family must step up and take some responsibility for that. You know, we all live with the great American fantasy, I call it, that we're going to live to be 100, we're going to be 100% capable, and we'll die quietly in our sleep after our 100th birthday party. It's kind of the common myth that we all embrace because we don't want to think about getting old and not being so chipper and capable. But the truth is that about 70% of us are going to need long-term care at some point. And the poorer we are about taking care of our own health, the more likely that is. So families, the adult children of these aging folks, have to step up and do something to help their elders when they begin to fail physically and mentally with problems such as Alzheimer's disease that you mentioned. That affects at least one in three people who are 85 and up, and it is an age-related risk. So when we have parents who are becoming cognitively impaired or physically impaired or both, which is also often the case, we've got to find a way to take care of them. And shared housing is the best way that there is out there to do that. Because when you look at the average cost of placing someone in even assisted living or a seniors community where there's minimal help, you're looking at costs that exceed the average retirement income that an older person has. When you say maybe they made a salary of $100,000, that far exceeds the national average salary. So when you ratchet those numbers down, even in places where care is less expensive in a facility like assisted living than it is in California, there's still not enough income to meet that need. So families are stepping up and saying, well, let's bring mom or dad here. And in some cultures, Asian cultures, Latino cultures, it's expected. People plan their lives around that likelihood that they're going to take in their elder or have them live with them in a multi-generation household. But in the greater, more dominant, perhaps, if you want to call it that, American culture, families are very scattered. Mom may live in Florida while the children live in Missouri, or mom may live in California and the children live in New York. And so we see a real problem with the uprooting of the elder because of the need for care, and then the adjustment that the family has to make collectively to try to get together and fit into one another's lives when they have not done that previously. And it creates some conflict.
I've run into issues with clients where, you know, they finally become empty nesters and they think, okay, we can really start saving for retirement now. The kids are all out of the house. They're educated. And then all of a sudden they find themselves taking care of their own parents because their parents didn't plan properly. So it throws this extra burden. Let me bring up an issue that we find sometimes in our practice, and we'll get a call from clients where, let's say you have a situation. Mom lives in Florida and the kids live in California. Kids go out to visit mom and they notice that either her mental capacity or mom and dad are doing things that you're saying, you know, there's something wrong going on here. What are the things that we can do to prepare ourselves for that or to keep up? I mean, in other words, if you're living in California and mom and dad are in Florida, how do you know something's going wrong? I ran into an issue where a trust was set up years ago, but the parents basically set up their bank accounts, their investment accounts, in a property they bought completely out of the trust, bypassing their whole estate plan.
Well, part of the difficulty with the scenario that you just mentioned is the failure to have the conversations about what will happen if we lose independence. And again, there is tremendous resistance in our culture to doing that because we are age phobic. We're disabled phobic, we're death phobic, we don't want to talk about these things. And it's unfortunate because then it hits the adult children like a slap in the face when maybe on some holiday or birthday they go out to Florida to visit mom or dad from California and they realize these people are not living in a safe situation. Or they're horrified to see that they haven't been paying their bills and they're stacked up on the table. Or they see that the parents have become hoarders and the place is a mess. I could go on because people tell me about these things every day at agingparents.com. So what we advise them is, look, if you're the adult child and you've got parents who are over 65, many of my colleagues who are in their 60s have parents who are in their 80s and 90s. I've got a mother-in-law who's 93, okay? And we need to have these conversations very early. At retirement is a good time. If somebody says, okay, I'm going to retire at 65 or 66, fine. Sit down with the adult children. Let's plan for the future. In the unlikely event that I should become disabled, what would we all do? That would be a good way to open this discussion. And if the parent is unwilling to open the discussion and initiate the subject, then the adult children must do so because we have to look at the cost of long-term care and how we're going to pay for it, how we're going to handle it ourselves if we can't reach into our funds and pay for it out of pocket. It's terrifying when someone is running out of money and the adult children don't know what to do because that elder really needs a lot of care. They either can't deliver it themselves or they don't want to give up what their plans were for retirement. It's very, very disruptive in people's lives, but it can be traced back to a failure to plan for this realistic possibility that we may not make it to 100 in perfect health.
You know, there's also the issue, too, as you say, we don't like dealing with these issues. And when you start losing your ability to think clearly, cognitive impairment starts to set in. Many times you may not realize what's going on. So unless there's somebody that really picks up on this, either a physician on a doctor visit or children visiting parents and really picking up on, hey, things aren't working right. What about the issue of having the proper estate planning documents? For example, if you don't have a durable power of attorney where somebody can step in, the problems that you run into court-appointed conservatorships, which can make matters even worse and more complicated.
These are terrible outcomes, having to go to court. Terrible outcomes. And again, this all goes back to having the conversation. If you are an adult child, let's say you're a boomer, okay? There are only 73 million of us. I'm talking to my colleagues here, okay? We have to approach the parents in our lives or the grandparents, whoever it is, the loved ones who are aging, and say, look, we need to look at what's going to happen if you can't manage by yourself. Let's talk about your estate plan. Do you have someone who is appointed as the power of attorney? Is that the right person? Can you trust them? Do you have documents that are current? But I also, Jim, blame attorneys because they only do the estate plan, and far too many of my brethren lawyers fail to look at what happens if the elder does not realize that he or she is impaired. Look, the typical estate plan has a trust and a will. The property, the house, whatever is in a trust. There is a trustee or two. Usually that's mom and dad, all right? One of them becomes impaired, the other is supposed to take over. But if they're both near the same age, both parents can be impaired at the same time. And the successor trustee, who might be an adult child and usually is supposed to take over when the parent becomes incapacitated. And in most estate planning documents, that is spelled out as saying when a doctor or two doctors declare that they are incapacitated. If they think they're fine, they're not going to go to the doctor. They're not going to go get evaluated. This is a real problem. And I am always pleading with my brethren in the law who do estate planning documents to address this possibility. There are ways that a lawyer can plan for that and have the succession, if we can call it that, pass automatically at a certain point to the successor trustee, the adult child, or the appointed person, if the elder refuses to be evaluated for capacity. So that is a problem that exists really everywhere because so many people who develop cognitive decline do not recognize any longer that they are impaired. The very part of the brain, and I'm speaking as a nurse here because I spent 10 years as a registered nurse. I visited thousands of elders at home. The part of the brain that is affected by Alzheimer's disease, for instance, the most common form of dementia, is such that our reasoning and cognitive abilities are damaged. Our logic, our ability to process information is damaged or destroyed. We can't tell that we're impaired if we have that ailment. Very often we don't know. It's not just denial, although it could be. It's really an inability to see it. So we have a real problem there in families because the elder thinks they're fine and the kids know they're not.
Let's talk about something that's related to this and something that we're seeing more and more, and that's elder abuse. I have a situation right now where there's four kids in the family. Mom gets Alzheimer's, names one of her kids as successor trustee. The problem is he's unemployed. And what he begins to do is drain large amounts of money out of the account, taking out, paying himself $5,000, $6,000 a month, unbeknownst to his other three siblings. And so we're starting to see more and more of this happen. And unfortunately, unless you've made the effort to plan for it, we're seeing this more and more and more.
Very common scenario, unfortunately. And it's quite a stereotype these days where we see the son, after dad passes, abusing mom because son is for some reason a ne'er-do-well or greedy or selfish or has a substance abuse problem, whatever the reasons are, it's a crime of opportunity. And when I say crime, I'm talking about under California law. We don't have very good laws in every state in this union. In this state where you and I are, Jim, we can prosecute an abuser for the crime of elder abuse and undue influence, which means manipulating that person but because of one's relationship of trust. That goes along. But in other states, we are casting about to get better laws, and there's been a resistance on the part of legislatures to pass them. In the meantime, no matter where you are, if you see a sibling abusing a parent, we have to step up and make every possible effort to address that before the elder becomes impoverished. Because a greedy person who steals from a parent is not stopped by anyone other than family members in most cases. Even law enforcement doesn't get involved because most of these cases of elder abuse are not reported to Adult Protective Services or law enforcement. And we're talking about $64 billion a year stolen from elders in this country. $64 billion. Most of the abusers are family members. Next, caregivers. Next most common abusers. And guess who's third, Jim? It's professionals.
It's absolutely amazing that we're seeing more and more about it. Why do you think there have not been more protective laws, number one? And number two, what do you do if you're in a family? In this case, one child is named trustee. And of course, the other children may not have information in terms of financial statements, expenses. So they may have no idea what this one child is doing to mom's estate, basically draining the money out and basically depriving them of their own inheritance.
Exactly right. If the adult children are beneficiaries under a trust or a will, they have a right to hire an attorney and to go into court and demand an accounting for what is happening to the estate at the hands of the person who is the appointed successor trustee. if Sonny Boy is in charge of the money and he's ripping off the estate, the adult children who are siblings and co-heirs of that estate can get an accounting. But again, they've got to ante up with the dollars to hire an attorney to go in and demand that accounting. They'll get an order because they have a right. They'll get an order from the court so that that person has to disclose what's happened. But again, it's very frustrating because a lot of times the thieving adult child keeps no record. And, you know, you've got to spend money to subpoena their bank records to see what they've done with it. And they've enriched themselves at the expense of everybody else. And they get away with it a lot. It's a very, very frustrating part of the law because we have trouble with enforcement. We have trouble with reporting. Jim, I have looked a 93-year-old woman in the eye. This person still had testamentary capacity. That is the ability to appoint a trustee. She did not have financial capacity, and there is a significant difference between those two. She could not handle her own funds anymore. Her son was the second person after her, the trustee, and he took over, okay? He was stealing from her. He wanted to uproot her, take her to his house, dump her in a daycare center all day long because he was working all day, and sell her house for his benefit. And, of course, he wanted to charge his mother rent, okay? It was awful.
Wow.
And I looked her in the eye, and I said, we'll call her Mary. Mary, your son is stealing from you. That is a crime under the laws of this state. He's manipulating your money, and he wants to take your house away from you. And she looked at me, and she said, Carolyn, I don't want my son reported, okay?
Mm.
So that speaks to the problem we have. Parents do not want to get their adult children in trouble, no matter how bad they are.
In elder abuse, Carolyn, I wonder if you might address this, is a very serious crime. I mean, you're talking about 4 or 5 years of imprisonment. So, you know, no parent wants to see one of their kids go to prison. And I think this is one of the issues why we see more of it, because parents are reluctant to address this issue.
Yes, they are reluctant. They're reluctant to report it. They're reluctant to address it. We have the phenomenon of the willing victim. They know they are being abused, just as this Mary that I talked about. She knew that her son was doing what was wrong, but she did not want to see him prosecuted. So they refuse to report. If someone else reports, they refuse to testify. And without sufficient evidence in a court of law, the district attorney is unable to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime occurred. And therefore, we have the continuing problem of abuse that is not punished, that people get away with, or even worse, it's never reported at all.
So, given the issues that we talked about diminished incapacity. We talked about the issue where basically mom and dad, or mom or dad alone, begins to run out of money. So all of a sudden there's a burden placed on the children. We've talked about elder abuse. If you want to avoid these things, what are the steps children should take that have parents that are aging that want to avoid these issues of diminished capacity, mental capacity, or the fact that mom and dad or mom or dad alone may not have the money to last their remaining lifetime?
Well, it is very important to start communicating about this early, and I describe in my book, The Family Guide to Aging Parents, how to have that conversation. There are suggestions that I make, and they include taking the initiative, looking at all that a parent has by the time they reach retirement age, and plotting out how those assets can be used to keep that parent safe until the end of life. Every financial professional such as you, every financial advisor, no matter what credentials come after their name, has an opportunity to help the parents and the adult children plan for how to use the parents' assets in the most prudent way so that they can last as long as possible. Now, if that includes selling the family home or being prudent about spending or working from a budget, fine. Whatever it is, the family needs to be included in the discussion with the financial professional. And this is an area where financial professionals are not expanding their traditional job of just working with the client. They need to invite the adult children into the office or into the conversation so that everyone is aware of what the issues are, how much there is in the estate, what are the best ways to save that so that it will last for the rest of a person's life. And then we need to look realistically about life expectancy. Okay, there are calculators, I'm sure you know, that can be used to tell us about what's realistic. You know, the average life expectancy for a man is somewhere in the 80s, and for a woman in the late 80s. I'm using general terms because it depends a lot on health, and I look at health risks differently because of my nursing background. But, you know, if the person's obese and smokes and has heart disease and diabetes, they're probably not going to live to be 100, but they probably are going to need long-term care. On the other hand, if they're normally healthy and try to watch their weight and get some exercise and take good care of themselves and manage whatever chronic diseases may be present, they probably will live longer than the average life expectancy. So all of those things need to be considered, talked about, budgeted for, and planned about. And if we discussed at the beginning of our conversation, the plan includes moving a parent in, people need to look at when that would be a good time to do it. They need to plan on how to address the differences between people. They need to look at the interfamilial conflicts that have existed and talk about how they're going to manage those. You know, you don't just plunk your aging parent in your house after being apart for 40 years or more and expect everything to be fine. It isn't always so fine. So there's help with that. There's help with all of these things out there. We offer some of it in our office at agingparents.com, but there are lots of other kinds of help too. And I think financial professionals play a key role in helping people do the planning that they need so that this can go as well as it possibly can.
A final question, Carolyn. Let's just assume that mom and dad have an estate plan. One issue that we see, they might have gotten an estate plan, a trust, wills, and maybe that was done 10 years ago. And, you know, quite honestly, they don't think about it. Family circumstances have changed. Their own net worth might have changed. Health issues. How do kids delicately approach mom and dad and say, mom, dad, you know, to find out, to make sure that everything is updated and in good working order in case something should happen? Because in one issue where we found a trust was set up, but none of the properties were in the trust, investment accounts weren't in the trust. So basically you had a document that was not effective because of what the parents had done. So what would you tell children how they can sort of maybe have a conversation or check up and say, hey, mom, dad, you mind if we check up on the estate plan, or when was the last time you had this reviewed? Because we know that things change over the years. Goodness, health can change, investments can change, net worth can change, the tax laws change.
Yes, and these are all really good points that you raised, because most people get their estate plan done if they do. Unfortunately, fewer than half of our population even has an estate plan, believe it or not. But for those who do, it's really important to understand that they don't go back to the lawyer every 5 years and say, let's update this. And the lawyers are not initiating this. The client disappears. Maybe the lawyer has passed away by the time the client gets to be 80 or 85. So to answer your question, I think it's important for the kids, the adult children, to initiate the conversation, make it their problem. Mom, dad, I would be feeling really bad if you had a fall or something happened and you had an accident and I didn't know even where to find the money to pay your mortgage or take care of your bill. We need to have this conversation. And if you approach it from the point of view, it's my problem, then the parent is less likely to be intimidated. Another key point. Most parents do not want to become a burden to their children. This is a common theme that most parents, not all, but most parents share, okay? So if you approach it from, say, look, if you don't want to burden me with the struggle that I would have if things were a mess, I really need you to share information with me. I'm not going to try to take your money away from you. I don't want to take advantage of you. I'm not trying to do this so I can put you in a home. That's a terror that many older people feel. You're going to take my freedom away and put me in a home. They're frightened about that. So they need reassurance. This is another important part of the conversation, to give them that reassurance. And to say, we need to look at your estate plan to make sure things are in order with the way the law is right now. And if the parent's lawyer did a lousy job, and I'm sorry to say some do, and the estate plan needs to be changed and updated, you had better jump in and do that while the parent still has the capacity to do it. So again, the best times to have these conversations are really early. Retirement age, 70, whatever, early birthdays. Don't wait till they're 90. And the parent says, don't worry about it, everything's fine, you know, I'm going to do that when I get old. Don't let them get away with that excuse. You have to gently press forward and insist, which is another part of this, because there's a lot of resistance on the part of the aging parent. They're afraid. They don't want to share information. They grew up during the Depression. People didn't talk about money. There's a lot of fear associated with this, and fear of loss of control being the key. But I think if we all consider that we're in this together, that we can help each other and our aging parent, we have a far better chance of making their last years dignified and safe And I think that's really my theme, is I want people to live in a way that's dignified and safe as they age, no matter what their income level is.
Now, Carol, I know you've written, I think your third book is coming out here, which is Succeed with Senior Clients, A Financial Advisor's Guide to Best Practices. Given the issues that we've discussed here this morning, what would you say is the best book that you have that would make this information available and help individuals guide their parents and plan for their parents and avoid the very issues that you and I have discussed today?
I think for families, the best book that I have is The Family Guide to Aging Parents, Answers to Your Legal, Financial, and Healthcare Questions. And that book is available at agingparents.com. It's available on amazon.com. The Family Guide to Aging Parents is set up to help people know what topics to discuss with aging parents, know what things cost, know how to get the help that parents might need, and to prevent abuse of their aging loved ones. Those are sort of the general topics. And as a corollary to that, if there is a financial professional involved, an advisor, in the picture, then the newest book, which is Succeed with Senior Clients, helps the advisor learn those very same things. How to prevent elder abuse, how to protect the client, how to plan for the costs of care, how to help the families have an intrafamilial discussion about the finances of the parent, the client that you have. So those two working together, I think, would make a beautiful outcome. For people who are not financial advisors, who are the lawyers, there's another book, and that's called Working with Aging Clients. That's published by the American Bar Association. And again, it addresses some of the same themes, how lawyers and other professionals can get into the picture of helping keep the aging client safer and facilitate communication between the generations so that we all achieve the best outcome that we can for the oldest people in our society.
Well, listen, Carolyn, I want to thank you for joining us on the program and bringing these issues to light and showing how they can be resolved. If our listeners would like to find out more about this, why don't you give out your website?
Sure. For families, we have agingparents.com. Agingparents.com has been around since 1996. My husband, Dr. Nicole Davis, who is a geriatric psychologist, and I took it over in about 2008. And we have been actively working with families for years now to help them resolve their conflicts and address the issues that we're talking about. We have lots of material there. There are free things. There's a YouTube channel. There are videos, a lot of information to help you get a grip on taking care of aging parents or just getting along with them better. And for professionals, we have aginginvestor.com, which is designed for people like you, Jim, in your field, to help expand the reach that you have with aging clients, so that you can include families and prevent elder abuse and facilitate, once again, the communication issues around finances and planning around retirement.
Give out the website one more time, Carolyn.
For families, agingparents.com, and for financial professionals, aginginvestor.com. And all of the books that I mentioned are available on both sites, and they are also available at amazon.com.
Well, listen, Carolyn, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best, and thanks for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim.
You know, Jim, we have been doing the programs together since 2001. And during that time, we've seen everything from, my gosh, if I look back at it, we had the bursting of the tech bubble, which really came home to roost then. We had the housing crisis and the subsequent crash that we experienced there. Lowest interest rates now. We have terrorist issues around the world. We've also had some boom markets, some booms in, say, for example, the metals for a while. But we've also been through two bear markets as well, much of which you could not have foreseen. But as you point out with the Clays, with our demonstrating family here this week, all of these problems, no matter what time you're in and what's going on, you can usually solve the problems as long as you have a workable plan. Because at least that gives you a framework off of which to work. And even if you have to make changes to that plan later on, you at least know what the plan is. And as somebody once said, failing to plan is planning to fail. Or in logic, it's called decision by indecision.
And that's what I hope that we can motivate you, because the whole paradigm for retirement planning, John, has really shifted in a major way. You know, it was all about the number. What is the number that you have to have to retire. And that's the wrong way to think about your retirement. That number means nothing, just like I told you how much it would take to produce $3,000 of income. $2.25 million. How many people have $2.25 million to produce $3,000 of income? The thing you have to think about today in retirement is, what is your income going to be? So the focus needs to be on two issues: longevity, the fact that you're likely to live longer, and two, the amount of income that you're going to need to sustain you throughout those retirement years. Well, on behalf of John Leffler and myself, as usual, we've run out of time, but we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.